Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Jetzt ist Herbst und bald stehen schon wieder die Feiertage vor der Tür. Das kann auch für Hunde ganz schön stressig sein. Viele Vierbeiner reagieren unter anderem mit einer gestörten Verdauung. Und das ist wiederum Stress für ihre Besitzer. Aber es gibt schnelle und einfache Hilfe. Das Probiotikum Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Streu einfach einen Beutel über das tägliche Futter. Die außergewöhnliche Zusammensetzung mit lebenden, guten Darmbakterien stellt das Gleichgewicht im Darm wieder her. Natürlich kannst du ProPlan Fortiflora auch präventiv oder bei alltäglichen Verdauungsbeschwerden einsetzen. Es unterstützt auch bei Ernährungsumstellungen oder Antibiotikaeinnahme. Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Jetzt auf shop.purina.de.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the NewsHour podcast, the first of two bonus editions, no less, ahead of the US presidential election. This one is coming to you from San Antonio in southern Texas on a beautifully warm morning. Now, this feels like a city that's going places. We're recording this in what's known as the Pearl, a small downtown district of newly restored old buildings and some new units, mostly given over to shopping, restaurants and coffee bars. And even at this time, it is filling up with people enjoying the sunshine. Now, San Antonio is just a couple of hours drive from the border with Mexico, and that influence is everywhere. Spanish is widely spoken. Two-thirds of the population identify as Hispanic. Many people have extended family in Mexico, and there is plenty of movement to and fro. People and goods. The two subjects we're going to talk about today, because that journey across the border is one we've made over the past couple of weeks. From Mexico's commercial hub, Monterrey, to the Texan border town of Laredo, through the cattle ranches just north of the border, and then on to San Antonio. Well, let me introduce my guests here today. Rogelio Sáenz, Professor of Sociology and Demography at the University of Texas in San Antonio. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
And Alejandra Arredondo, reporter based in San Antonio. And Alejandra covers migration in Texas and across the country. A very good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
How are you both?
Pretty good.
Enjoying the slightly cooler weather, I think.
Yeah, nice.
It's been a very hot summer, hasn't it? I mean, I just wanted to ask you, first of all, just to set the scene. I mean, Alejandro, you're not from here, you're from Colombia. What's it like living in San Antonio? What's the vibe, if you like?
It's a great city, like you mentioned. It's a city that is expanding, I think, has a lot of potential. And it's very interesting seeing as a majority Latino city instead of the U.S. Sometimes it feels very different from the rest of the country, right?
Yeah. Rogelio, do you think that? I mean, you're actually from a border town, I think, originally.
I'm originally from the Valley area, little town Mercedes there between McAllen and Brownsville. And for us growing up, that was a smaller kind of environment. So we always saw San Antonio as kind of the place to go. And I was lucky enough to have gotten an offer here at UTSA and have been here now for 13 years.
And I'm just wondering, do people here look south or do they look north, if you know what I mean? Is people's gaze towards Mexico, or at least many people, rather than to the rest of the U.S.? What would you say, Alejandra?
I say it's a city that has a very particular history, very particular culture, and it's a culture of intertwined between American culture and Mexican culture. And it's become its own thing, and people are very proud of what it means, you know, Chicano movement kind of took that off.
Yeah, I think you have that southern gaze, I think, because here in Texas, there has been always the kind of the emphasis on the northern triangle, or the Texas triangle,
which is
San Antonio, Austin, Dallas-Fort Worth, and Houston. But increasingly, and there was a series here in the in the San Antonio Express News that focused on the Southern Triangle, and that is the San Antonio, and then connected to the Valley, and then connected to Monterrey as well. And then that trade that happens that is often overlooked because of the emphasis on the Texas Triangle with the other cities in the state.
Just one quick question, especially as you're a demographer. How much is San Antonio growing, and where is that growth coming from? I mean, is it more people coming from Latin America, but are there also people coming from other places in the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, in that you do see San Antonio has been among the largest cities. The city that has been growing fastest with respect to absolute change as well as percentage change. So that is really taking place here. And you have people that are coming internationally, but you also have people coming from all over the country, particularly from California. That has always been what the media has picked up, that movement of Californians to
And why is
to
that?
Texas.
Is that because it's the cost of living is a bit cheaper here?
Yeah, I think that's probably what's driving it. And that started with the pandemic, as people were able to work remotely, where you had people that were paying so much money for their homes, their rents, and so forth, and then Texas providing that opportunity.
Texas, of course, a very staunchly Republican state overall.
Yeah, exactly. So we.
But is that the case in San Antonio?
San Antonio is much more a blue city.
Democratic.
Yeah, very much so, as is the case with the other larger cities here in the state as well.
Yes, right. Let's listen to our first bit of audio from our reporting for the past couple of weeks. And it relates to the movement of people first, immigration, legal, and the big issue, of course, in the presidential election, illegal migration. I wanted to play you, first of all, this clip of a woman that we met in Monterrey in northern Mexico. She's called Rosa. We met her in a refuge for migrants. She was with her husband and their three children. They're all from Venezuela. Interestingly, they tried, first of all, they say they were fleeing political repression, the dire economic situation in Venezuela. They initially tried to go to Peru. They said they faced huge amounts of discrimination in Peru. So they had to come back to Venezuela, and then they decided to make the journey north. And Alejandra, I'm sure this is a common thing that you find in your reporting. So they went to Colombia, first of all, up across the infamous Darien Gap, very dangerous crossing there through the jungle, up through Central America, and then finally ended up in Mexico. And interestingly, in this clip, we hear from Rosa, who told us she was really worried about crossing the jungle in that divides North and South America, that Darien Gap. But actually, the real problems came when she arrived in Mexico.
We thought that the jungle was the hardest part. But when we got to Mexico, we saw it was even worse. Because if you are not running from the immigration police, you are paying the cartels to let you continue your journey north. Otherwise, they'll kidnap you or hurt you. What happened to us was that a guy told us he'd give us a lift. We'd been walking for days. He said he'd take us in his car, but before we knew it, we were being held hostage at a farm. Then you have to pay. Otherwise, they won't let you go.
Alejandra, I mean, is that a common story? Have you heard stories like that from people that you've spoken to?
Definitely. So the Biden administration has first enacted a policy of trying to bring the encounters number down. And that is done through two things. First, asylum restrictions at the border that they have enacted after the Title 42, which was a Trump-era rule that was in place until May 2023. And then they started with a series of restrictions. And
it was essentially a cap, wasn't it? That once the number of encounters or crossings reached a certain level, then they'd say, right, the border's closed.
Exactly. That happened in September this year, this new rule. And then the other factor that has contributed greatly to putting the numbers of encounters down is collaboration with Mexico, right? And that, what Rosa said, is something that I've encountered in my reporting multiple times. People saying that Mexico is the worst part of the journey, even worse than the Darien Gap. And that, I think, a lot of it has to do with what she was talking about, with the collaboration of Mexican authorities, immigration authorities, and kind of acting as an invisible barrier for migrants, and especially trying to cut the movement of people through Mexico, people who are going north to the United States. Yeah.
Donald Trump talks about a crisis at the border, that there's an invasion of people. He's always saying, well, President Biden has allowed more people in than at any other time. He's failed to control that flow. But what are the reasons, do you think, why? I mean, there's no doubt the numbers did surge, particularly last year. They've now come down a little bit since those controls. But what do you think the reasons are for that? Why so many people heading up through Central America trying to get to the U.S.?
So I think we have to see two things that the U.S. is experiencing, and I think we have to talk about a global displacement and a global movement that we don't only see that in the U.S., but we obviously, I'm sure you see it in Europe too. In the continent, especially in the Americas, there's multiple different countries that are experiencing political instability, social instability. A big one is Venezuela, where that woman was from, is the biggest diaspora in the Americas right now. More than 8 million people have fled Venezuela since 2014. And that has fueled in part of this movement to the north, right? Different countries. Ecuador has also experiencing gang violence. Peru, for example, political instability. Haiti. So you have different, kind of situations in the whole continent. And then also there's been, I think, a very important factor that is often overlooked is the strength of the U.S. economy. And the strength of the U.S. labor market and how is also a factor that is pulling people to the United States.
Yeah, Rogelio, I was going to ask you precisely that point. We often talk about push factors, why people leave, and it's often economic reasons. It's often reasons of security as well. But there are pull factors, aren't there? There are reasons why, as ever, why people want to come to the U.S.
Right. You have those factors, as Alejandra mentioned, the U.S. economy and how favorably it's doing, even though there's a lot of people complaining about inflation and things like that, in terms of the unemployment rate is very low. And so that also attracts people, and particularly in particular industries, construction, for example. You see here in San Antonio, the place is booming with so much construction. You go to Austin, and it's even much greater there.
And so what, that construction industry needs workers, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then you look at other kind of industries, the restaurant, the tourist industries, particularly here in San Antonio. It's very much of a tourist city that depends very heavily on workers who are working as cooks, waiters, in the lower levels of the economy as well.
And is it a fact of life here? And it's something that people, don't want to talk about too openly, but they do when you probe a little deeper, that actually, many industries do employ undocumented migrants, and if they didn't, they would struggle to survive.
Exactly, yeah. So you have that, and the kind of the bigger picture that is going on has to do with the aging of the country. We're talking about a country where now it's something like birth and death. You have like 1.1 births for every one death in the United States, and it's very soon it's going to have more death than birth, what demographers call natural decline. So you're going to have a massive amount of need for labor that the country won't be able to supply, because we had a massive decline in births from the time of the Great Recession to the present. So just think of if Donald Trump were to become the president and does the massive raids, the massive deportations that he's going to that he says that he's going to do, the tremendous negative impact that it would have on the economy.
I think it's a good point to now hear from someone who's very unhappy about the number of people coming across the border illegally. And I have to stress, Rosa, who we heard from, had an interview with the immigration authorities so that her family could try and claim asylum. So she is trying the legal route. But we've also spoke to people who said, look, it's taking too long. We're just going to go across. We're going to hear from Stephanie. She's called Stephanie Crisp Canales. Her family's owned a ranch for more than 100 years in South Texas, about an hour from the border. She's also a head teacher at the local school, in fact. And she's had some real problems with groups of undocumented migrants coming across, often led by the smugglers in vehicles. Let's hear what she told us a little earlier this week.
We've always had people coming across illegally, but we've never, ever had groups of, 23 of 50, of 100 and something, ever. And the ones that used to come, when I was young, they were just here because they wanted to work. They were honest people. They were just here because they wanted a better life and they wanted a job. But these that the cartel are bringing over now, I mean, they want a free handout. They want to leave their country because they are wanted for other crimes and stuff.
And how do you know that? Do you know that for sure? I mean, if there's groups of sort of 50, they can't all be murderers, can they?
No, but when the Border Patrol run their names, their fingerprints, and so forth, because we've had several large groups here on our property that the Border Patrol have caught, and they will tell us, yeah, you know, this one's wanted for murder. This one's, we're like, oh, man, you know, I mean, that's really scary. When you live here and you see it every single day, it's not letting up, and I don't think it's going to until somebody gets in office that's going to truly, truly shut the border down and not let all of these people come in.
And who is that, do you think? Is that Donald Trump?
I mean, right now, that's our only hope. So that's what we're hoping for. Because when he was president, when Trump was president, we did not see one person walk through our property. Nothing while he was president. So like him or not like him, that's a fact.
Stephanie Crisp Canales, cattle rancher in South Texas. Alejandra, there's a couple of points I just want to pick up on from what Stephanie was talking about. I mean, she sort of at the end was implying, and I've no reason to doubt what she was saying about her experience, but the idea that there were far fewer undocumented migrants coming during Donald Trump's time, or that there were none. I mean, there were, weren't there?
Yeah, they definitely were. But it's true that after the pandemic, which also was a coincidence after, you know, Biden administration, after when Donald Trump's term ended, that's when we saw the increase in people coming to the country, which has a lot to do with economies and governments affected by the pandemic and what we were talking about earlier about the displacement of people. But also, a lot of it has to do with restrictions, right? Restrictions at the border of people who can claim asylum at ports of entry, like Rosa did, for example. When you restrict that, what has happened is people are trying to, they created a bottleneck in Mexico, because if people can go to the ports of entry, they're trying to go different routes, like people that she sees in her ranch and that I've talked to in my reporting.
The other thing she talked about is how many people with criminal records in their home countries are coming over. And the implication seemed to be that it was a majority. Is that right? Is there any evidence for that?
So that's a talking point that Republicans repeat a lot. We hear it from Trump all the time about how the country is being run over by illegal migrants who have criminal records, especially. So I recently went to Aurora, Colorado, which is a city he has been put on the map as a city that is allegedly run by gangs. And then the reality there, when talking to people there, they say, hey, you know, a lot of people from Venezuela have come here. We can't deny that there's some people who commit crimes. There's some people who commit robberies. There's some people who do bad things. But that's not the majority of the people. And they've actually been affected by, they told me that they've been affected by this narrative about people coming to their homes or to their apartments, saying things to them, saying, oh, we don't want you here. And that they feel this environment of fear because of this narrative that's being created around them.
Rogelio, I don't know whether this is something you've looked into. I mean, is there any evidence at all that increases in migration cause a spike in crime levels?
No. For long history, sociological, criminological kind of work has shown that immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than the native-born population. That is going back to the 1800s, 1900s, and to the present. So there is that image then that does not really connect with the actual empirical information.
How do you explain then the sort of fear factor that's been generated during this election? Obviously, it's a strategy by Donald Trump and the Republicans to create this idea that the country is changing irrevocably because of migration. But it's obviously resonating, and we've seen Kamala Harris for the Democrats having to sort of change her tone about immigration mm-hmm. too. So it's something that people feel. I mean, how do you explain that?
Yeah, so this has been a trope, I think, that the politicians have used, and increasingly, I think, during the Trump era, that you have these criminals that are coming in. They're taking over our country. They're bringing so many drugs and so forth. So that is a well-worn kind of strategy that has been used, and I think it's been amped up during this particular
period. But it clearly does resonate, though. Is that because people are sort of feeling, insecure about their jobs, the way the world is changing, globalization? Is it something to do with that, do you think?
So, actually, I was yesterday in Houston talking about this with people, especially people who have been in the country for a lot of years, and people who are undocumented have been in this country for 10, 20 years. I mean, they obviously don't vote, but a lot of them that I talked to supported Trump. He asked them, how do you support Trump? He's talking about mass deportation of undocumented migrants like yourself. And they feel this, that they've been left behind by the Democrats and by the Republicans because they've been promising immigration reform, and that hasn't happened. And they're also crushed by inflation, bad consumer price index, and goods and services going up, and they're not able to afford. So when they hear Trump saying, oh, the reason that this is happening is because of these people that are coming here, they're cutting in line,
Right, and but do they also feel that there are, people, bad people in quotes, coming over from their countries? I mean, is there any data to suggest that people with criminal records back in Venezuela, back in Honduras or whatever, are trying to get away from that and come here?
I mean, from what I've seen and the people I've talked to, I think it's obviously when you have a huge or a increased amount of people coming, you might have people who have but that's not a reality of the majority of people that are coming in. And again, it's this kind of idea that Trump and Republicans are repeating of blaming and putting the finger on migrants as to kind of fuel those fears and those very fears and anxieties that people have, and pointing an enemy at. They're the reason why you can't get citizenship. They're the reason why inflation is up and that the job market is not according to your needs,
Rogelio, have you been shocked by the rhetoric in the campaign? And I ask that because, throughout our journey, we've been talking to people in Mexico and here saying, what do you think about the rhetoric that you've heard, particularly from Donald Trump and his Republican Party? And most people actually have sort of been quite phlegmatic about it. They sort of shrugged and said, he's campaigning to be president. He says these things, but he doesn't really mean them. Mm-hmm. But do you take him seriously?
He's using that particular strategy again. To one thing that you see with Trump is that he has been a masterful politician in terms of seeing what people's weaknesses are, what they care about, and going after them with so much data that is false information, that is lies and half truths and so forth. So, but that has resonated very well, and I think that one of the reasons that he has been so effective is that the Democrats have, for the most part, stepped back, tiptoed, and they don't want to get into the fray of the immigration debate. And I think we see it also with Kamala Harris as well. She, when they ask her about immigration, she kind of tiptoes a little bit. And we see, I think, in terms of the Biden administration and the Harris administration, there were not weaklings when it came to patrolling the border and so forth. There were bigger forces that were taking place, as Alejandra pointed out earlier, but they also are not necessarily seen as the friends of immigrants. You look at people who are immigrant advocates and so forth, and they have concerns as well with Biden as well as Harris.
Yeah, and some have said that she has been pretty vague on her plans mm-hmm. to deal with illegal migration and hasn't set those out. Listen, I think it's time just to move on to the other subject that we've been talking about, which I do want to talk about for a few minutes, and it's about the sort of commercial ties between this part of South Texas and northern Mexico. I mean, these are ties that go back to the early 90s with NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and I guess before. I mean, this is an area where I imagine there's been trade across the border for many, many decades. And the reason why we wanted to look at that, again, it goes back to our friend Mr. Trump, who, again, on the campaign trail has been talking about putting up more trade barriers. He said he wants to put a universal tariff on all imports into the U.S., which would clearly be a big problem for Mexico. Now, when we were in Monterrey, we went to a factory that produces machine parts that actually go into the machines that make cars. And the car industry is huge in northern Mexico, as you know. And we met Sergio Lopez. He runs this small business, employs about 15, 20 people. And we asked him how business was doing and what the imposition of those tariffs might mean. Let's have a listen.
There is a lot of businesses going on between Mexico and the United States, also with Canada, but particularly with the U.S. And now with what's going on with all the new car factories setting up here, there is a lot of businesses coming to us from the United States. Mr. Trump is a businessman. He's tough, but I think he knows how far to go. I understand that he wants to protect his country and his people, but imposing this tariff is like the U.S. shooting itself in the foot, because the only thing it'll bring is more problems.
That was Sergio Lopez, who runs a business, a factory in Monterrey. Rogelio, I don't know, have you been down to Laredo, the border crossing at Laredo recently?
Yeah.
I mean, it is extraordinary when you stand there and watch the lines and lines of trucks coming across the border, and in fact going both ways.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, this is an area, in a way, although the border is there and you have the Rio Grande, this whole area, South Texas and northern Mexico, feels almost like sort of one commercial hub. Is that fair?
Yeah, you really see the massive amount of trade that is happening again and going in both directions, but particularly trucks coming from Mexico and to the United States as well. So that really is an indicator of the massive, big activity that is taking place, and the implications of that if they were to raise the tariffs and so forth, the major impact that it would have on people here.
Has all that been good in the past 20, 30 years for San Antonio, for example? I mean, has it brought prosperity to this part of the world?
I think it has. I think that you have the major leaders in each country are San Antonio, I think, and Monterrey. So that really is that path that has taken place. You really have also seen the diversification of the immigrant population as well, coming from Mexico, that you have individuals who are entrepreneurs and so forth, that they are coming to places like San Antonio, Houston, and so forth. So it has expanded also the economic base of the immigrant population.
Alejandro, I mean, there is a sort of irony here, isn't there? Because we've been talking about the movement of people. Now we've just been hearing about the movement of goods. The two things go hand in hand, but people want globalization when it comes to goods because it means the availability of goods and it means cheaper prices. Not so much when it's about the globalization of human populations.
It's definitely, ironic. And I feel especially with trade, with Mexico, I think those things really came together during the Trump administration, where he wanted Mexico to collaborate more with stopping migration. And he said, we're going to impose bigger tariffs on your government if you don't do that, you know. And I think since then, it's a topic of conversation that has come out along, and that it kind of gives us a bit of a taste of what a Trump administration could do in this and what leverage he could use for trade, for helping getting the Mexican government to collaborate more.
I mean, Rogelio, do you think he would do that? I mean, it seems unlikely that, I mean, a universal tariff would really unpick the whole of NAFTA, now the USMCA, wouldn't it? I mean, it seems unlikely that, well, particularly I imagine business leaders here would be picking up the phone to the White House saying, look, you can't do this.
But I think it is very much consistent with his nationalism kind of emphasis that he's been putting in, how he's going to protect the borders of the U.S. from people or from goods or from whoever's coming and taking our jobs away and stopping the criminal element that he is talking about and so forth. So you have all those that are consistent. And I think that during his administration, we did see things that we would have said, I don't think he would have done that. That seems like a very serious, destructive kind of situation, and efforts were made at that particular point in time.
Listen, I think we're nearly out of time, so I'm going to put you on the spot here and ask you a really cruel question. Who do you think is going to win the election?
I don't know. The polls are really tied, like you've seen. And then there's... it's definitely what you were saying. He definitely taps on something in people, and he's very popular specifically among working class voters, regardless of ethnicity. And that's something that we've seen across the board with Hispanic voters and African American voters, and obviously started with white American voters. So, but I mean, it's
on a knife edge.
Yeah.
Rogelio, with your sociologist and demographer hat on, just tell us briefly. I mean, is all the sort of migration into Texas, is that changing the way that the state is voting? I mean, we were talking before we started recording how Senator Ted Cruz, who's up for re-election, I mean, he's facing a very tight race, which seems extraordinary if you think back to perhaps what things were like 20 years ago.
Right. Yeah, for the last 30 years or so, it's been kind of a Republican-led dominant state. There has been the idea, starting back 30 years ago, when we were seeing the population projections and changes that were going to take place, and the youthful Latino population and the Latino population just became the numerical majority last year, 2023, surpassing the white population. And we see right now with the citizens of voting age population, but Texas added 1.6 million in the last 4 or 5 years. Of that 1.6 million, 1 million of those were Latinos who mostly turned 18 and are now eligible to vote, as well as those individuals who have become naturalized citizens.
Are they more likely to vote Democrat?
Probably that continues to be the case, that there is a majority kind of a Democratic support, but increasingly you have seen the movement towards Trump, and particularly in the border areas that we saw last time. I think Trump won Zapata. It was unheard of for Republicans to win the border counties. And then you see, I think, in terms of the connections of the jobs that people hold along the border, many of those jobs are connected to Homeland Security, Border Patrol. So you have that economic factor as well that is at play.
Very interesting. Thank you very much indeed. Rogelio Sáenz, Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas in San Antonio, and Alejandra Arredondo, reporter based in San Antonio. Great to have you with us. Thank you so much for coming down today. It's starting to get a bit hotter now, isn't it? The sort of nice cool of the morning is slightly easing away. That is it for this edition, the special edition of the NewsHour podcast. As I mentioned earlier, it's the first of two bonus editions ahead of the US presidential election. My colleague, Jamie Kumarasamy, is heading, I think, very shortly to Wisconsin, one of those crucial swing states in the presidential election, and he will be reporting from there for NewsHour and bringing you that second edition of our podcast. But from me, from Rogelio and Alejandra, thank you very much indeed.
Jetzt ist Herbst und bald stehen schon wieder die Feiertage vor der Tür. Das kann auch für Hunde ganz schön stressig sein. Viele Vierbeiner reagieren unter anderem mit einer gestörten Verdauung. Und das ist wiederum Stress für ihre Besitzer. Aber es gibt schnelle und einfache Hilfe. Das Probiotikum Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Streu einfach einen Beutel über das tägliche Futter. Die außergewöhnliche Zusammensetzung mit lebenden guten Darmbakterien stellt das Gleichgewicht im Darm wieder her. Natürlich kannst du ProPlan Fortiflora auch präventiv oder bei alltäglichen Verdauungsbeschwerden einsetzen. Es unterstützt auch bei Ernährungsumstellungen oder Antibiotikaeinnahme. Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Jetzt auf shop.purina.de.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI for People.